I would say it this way, who financial institutions lend to and what they support financially absolutely shapes the economy that we'll have in the future.
Welcome to the City Age podcast. I'm Alon Markovich, and I'm here with Anna Stafford.
And that was Christine Bergeron, president and CEO of VanCity, a leading values-based community credit union. Before we get to our conversation with Christine, we're going to share our conversation with Ben Almond, CEO of Engineering Services Canada at SNC-Lavalin. We chat with Ben about SNC-Lavalin's newly launched Decarbonomics platform, which is a data-driven solution to decarbonize the built environment in a cost-effective way.
Ben joined SNC-Lavalin in 2021. He leads a 3,500-person strong team to drive sustainable long-term growth across the transportation, citizen development, power and renewables, life sciences, and industrial markets. Prior to joining SNC-Lavalin, Ben was the regional managing director for the combined Jacobs and CH2M Hill team in Canada. Here is Anna's conversation with Ben Almond.
Thanks for coming on the show, Ben. It's really great to have you here. To start off, I'm wondering if you can tell us a bit about Decarbonomics, which is for decarbonizing buildings in particular. So can you walk us through what Decarbonomics is?
Sure. Well, thanks for having me. Maybe I can start with why Decarbonomics or why buildings. So buildings are the largest source of carbon emissions, and the built environment contributes around 40% of global carbon emissions. And the majority of buildings that are going to exist in 2050 are already here. So it's not practical to tear down cities and rebuild them from scratch, not to mention there's also an impact of that. We've got to find ways to fix what we've already got. And if you think about places like the Greater Toronto Area, there's huge amounts of investment required just to retrofit and make steps forward in that direction. So, you know, all this in mind, retrofitting isn't something that's a luxury that folks that are, you know, well-to-do in the real estate world can take on. This is something we have to do if we intend to reach those net zero goals and reduce carbon footprint. So we took a step back as an organization and said, okay, well, we see challenges in bringing these things to life, right? People don't necessarily know how to approach the challenge that's out in front of them. And it's not an uncommon thing for us to come across, you know, clients that are in our big three geographies, the UK, Canada, the US, that are out asking for feasibility studies and, you know, looking to spend time, money, energy to come up with an approach when, you know, we believe the fact of the matter is we need data. And we need a data-driven decision-making approach that allows you to prioritize where you put your money, right? Because you got to think about it as, you know, our old return on investment. You get a carbon return on investment if you spend that money well, or you can make a small impact if you spend it based on gut feel. So, you know, what we did was built this data-driven end-to-end platform, and it's really meant to help our clients make good decisions and then check back in on how they're doing on that path. So it starts with, you know, we build a baseline. We work with our clients to understand what they have in their real estate portfolio, how they're operating today, what their current cost and carbon performance looks like. So once we understand that baseline and where we're starting from, including the goals that the client wants to achieve in terms of decarbonizing their overall portfolio, their real estate portfolio. We work with them using data that we've built up in field assessments, past deployments of Decarbonomics and experience from around the world. We help them build a roadmap that takes them from where they are today to where they intend to be with smart investments and interventions, some of those requiring no money at all, that help them make maximum carbon return on the changes that they choose to make. And as we go and we execute on that roadmap, we evaluate along the way and we test back, are we achieving the results that we intended to achieve? And again, if we need to alter course or adjust, you know, we can use that data to help us continuously reappraise how we're doing, informing the model and the decision-making. And you know, that delivery environment just continues to improve over time. And in the end, what we're seeing is, you know, clients are achieving decarbonization goals very quickly. In fact, deployment of the first interventions is happening within weeks of the start of the work, not months, not years, weeks. And that, you know, if you think about the barriers to success of decarbonization of buildings in particular, you know, one is always money, right? And time is money. And, you know, getting stakeholder engagement, finding access to funding, all of those things sort of come back to an ability to demonstrate those improvements. And frankly, if you can't move quickly into action, we're never going to achieve the goals that we're setting out. I mean, we've set some really aggressive timelines. So being able to quickly go from, hey, I have this portfolio of buildings, you know, across a nation, across a city, across a neighborhood, and I don't know where to start. You know, rather than ripping the insulation out because that's the only thing you know what to do, you know, we can help make those decisions in a way where you maximize your carbon return really quickly on those investments, including no-cost investments. So it's a pretty exciting tool. And you know, we're really seeing great results with people.
Yeah. So what would some of those early solutions be? Kind of the things that can be deployed within weeks. Can you give some examples of what those tools might be?
Sure. I mean, some of the interventions are as simple as how you're operating your heating and ventilation systems, right? Some of them are how you're managing external doorways, et cetera. So where your heat losses are coming from and that type of thing. So there's some pretty, call it basic approaches, but at the same time, you know, the benefit of the overall model gives you the ability to sort of step up to a higher level and think, you know, if you had 100 buildings, where do you begin? Right. And you know, the data built into the experience that that is feeding the model allows those choices to take place with much more certainty than we've ever had in the past. You know, it's not gut feel and intuition. It's based on experience and pre and post inspection and testing and things like that that have informed the information in the model, which I think is, you know, when you have something like that that's proving itself out to be, you know, 95% on the mark, when you take the data-based model and then perform field-based inspections and testing afterward, you know, that's a pretty great resource to have in your hands.
What do you think is really unique about decarbonomics? What gap is it filling in the industry? What do you think here is the thing that's really new and exciting about it?
Decarbonizing anything can be overwhelming, expensive, slow, and frankly, we haven't had enough real-world experience in the past to be able to make great data-driven decisions. So decarbonomics is quite honestly a way to make smart, accurate, data-driven decisions in a portfolio in a way that's fast and to get the most carbon bang for your buck. And it happens so quickly and so effectively. It stands out to me as something, you know, I'm an engineer by trade, right? And we love to study things. You know, frankly, we need to move quickly past the studying phase and into the acting phase. And this sort of short circuits that conversation by using data and experience from around the world to bring into one real estate portfolio of our client and help them make good decisions. And, you know, one of the things we try to do in every piece of work that we do is to bring global solutions into local markets. And this is the epitome of that.
Right. Now, to that point, do you think we are on track to reach our climate goals, in particular, reaching net zero by 2050? At this point, do you think we're on track for that?
If I'm completely honest about it, no, we're not. You know, we've taken a step back, and as, you know, engineers and hopefully thoughtful folks who care about the future of the world and particularly Canada, you know, we've done a couple of engineering net zero reports where we've taken a bit of an engineer's lens to Canada's path to 2050 and 2030 targets. And we've really not been able to achieve significant reductions in total annual greenhouse gas emissions. We've seen improvements in the electricity sector, but that's been eaten up by other sectors across the country, you know, maybe driven by economic and population growth. But, you know, we've only dropped greenhouse gas emissions by about 1.1% since 2005. And if we're going to meet 2030 targets that are a 45% drop in greenhouse gas emissions, we would have to replace every combustion engine car, truck, and van in BC, Ontario, and Quebec in the next 8 years. And that doesn't take into account the investment that we would have to have in place to be able to power all of that new electrical equipment that would be out there. You know, so maintaining this like status quo is not going to let us achieve those objectives. And I know I keep coming back to that, but we've really got to change how we think about this and shock our systems and look for commitments from government, industry, and society to do things differently if we want to achieve those goals. You know, and I think we've got to look for some quick wins in specific sectors while we move with those bigger social and economic changes. But, you know, we can't afford to wait.
Mm-hmm. Are you hopeful or optimistic about our ability to shift gears and change direction and sort of move away from the status quo? Are you optimistic about our ability to do that?
Call it cautiously optimistic, Anna. I think that the thing society has proved time and time again is in the face of catastrophe, we find a way to prevail. And I'm not saying this is, you know, the sky isn't going to fall on us. You know, we won't wake up to rivers of fire, I hope. But when we actually embrace that we have a real challenge that we face as a society, we've time and time again been able to show that we can rise to the occasion and come up with good solutions. And the good news with dealing, you know, particularly with these net zero type goals is we have all the tools at our fingertips. It's a matter of executing and finding ways to move more quickly with that execution to move us into that future state, you know, in a time period that, you know, feels a little bit impossible today.
Yeah, you know, you touched on something there that I think in kind of an indirect way brings me to my last question for you, which is this idea that to reach our goals, we're really going to need a mix of solutions, lots of different sectors, industries, and lots of different people coming to the table. I follow you on LinkedIn. I've sort of seen some other interviews with you, and I know you're very outspoken and passionate about equity and diversity in the workplace in particular. I'm wondering if, to close out this conversation, if you could tell me a bit about why that's important to you, but also what equity and diversity has to do with reaching net zero.
Yeah, that's a great question. One I could probably talk for hours on, but, you know, contextually, in 2005, my world changed, right? I was a young, able-bodied white guy, who was pretty quick and, you know, seemed to be progressing well in his career. And I broke my back. I was out downhill mountain biking. I had a mechanical failure and I came home a wheelchair user some months later. And I got to see the world through a different lens, and one that, you know, wasn't one of the big crowd, and had to think of things differently and didn't always feel on the inside. So, you know, I think when I think about this topic in particular, I would focus a little more directly on inclusion in particular. And when I think about this in our field of engineering, and I'll get to why I think this is important for net zero in a second. I think it's really important to be able to create a space where people feel comfortable contributing in and they're safe to share their viewpoints, their challenges, their difficulties. You know, we need to be able to encourage more discussion and challenge ourselves on outcomes where, you know, when people feel like they're a part of something, they're much more willing to put in that extra energy to lean in and push and embrace, you know, the path forward. And I think diverse teams are the outcome of creating that environment where people feel safe and that they can contribute and they're a part of something. And those diverse teams have been proven time and time again to outperform, you know, teams that have singular backgrounds, singular experiences when it comes to coming up with better solutions, coming up with more inclusive answers in terms of design. And when I say that, you know, you think about something that we all interact with day to day, you know, a transit station or a roadway design. Imagine that instead of it being designed by, you know, one group of people, all of a sudden you have different views on what interacting with that piece of infrastructure feels like. Maybe you have someone asking themselves, you know, would I feel safe there late at night after taking the last train? Are there barriers that others might not notice that maybe I would, because I have to think about, you know, a curb or a crack in ways that others may not, right? And that helps the team get to better solutions. So when I think about reaching net zero and reaching it quickly, I think having people from different industries, having people from different backgrounds with different life experiences included in the question of how we solve this will help us get there much more quickly. And I had an old mentor that used to challenge when we would mobilize teams to solve problems. He would commonly ask, you know, are you mobilizing the people that created the problem to solve it? Or are you bringing some different ideas and different viewpoints to the table that may see it from a different angle and have a very unique solution to a problem? And I think to solve our global net zero challenge, it would be so beneficial to get through these hurdles if we all rallied around the desired outcome and took in some different viewpoints and encouraged people to come with unique solutions and views on the challenge, because we might come up with something that was right in front of our eyes that we couldn't even see.
I always appreciate kind of bringing the conversation to a bit of a more human place and really appreciate you sharing all of that. It's been a really great conversation. We like to end all of our interviews with some rapid fire questions. So I'm going to give those to you right now. What's the coolest thing you have in your office?
Well, I'll focus on the office as a whole, because we actually, we do not have, I don't have an assigned office.
Oh, interesting.
So it's pretty, pretty bland intentionally, because anyone could be in there on any given day. But in our head office in Montreal, we have what we call the Lava Lab. And it's a space we've developed in multiple offices around the world that's focused on innovation, collaboration, and engaging people in solutions. And it allows us to leverage technology to sort of bring to life a bit of that conversation we just had around getting different views on things. And we do everything from virtual reality model reviews, where people are walking through, you know, a designed piece of infrastructure and experiencing it in what feels a little bit like real life with a 3D model, to, you know, engaging in conversations with community and thought leaders on some big problems and bringing some of our folks from around the world into those discussions. So I think that's one of the coolest things I've had a chance to use and interact with in the office in particular. And it's probably something that all of us, you know, could give some thought to in terms of how we leverage the smart answers out there in the world to solve some of our local problems.
Yeah, that's very, very cool. What's a city that has surprised you?
You know, I lived in Edmonton for a number of years, and I hadn't been back in quite a while. And I was there meeting with our team in Edmonton before Christmas. And Edmonton is reimagining itself and executing on essentially a redesign of a city that was very car-driven, spread, and, you know, the downtown was a place that nobody wanted to spend time. And now, you know, I showed up and I was in the ICE district and there are people around and there's a different feel to the city than I experienced when I lived there. And, you know, leveraging more transit to access, more transit oriented type development, you know, just the type of thinking has changed and the way the city feels has changed. And I found that incredibly encouraging, you know, that, yeah, I mean, it's something that anyone can endeavor to take on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've had a lot of speakers at events recently from Edmonton, and it sounds like they have a lot of interesting things going on. So that's very cool. If you didn't have your current career, what would you be doing instead?
Well, let's say outside of the most common, you know, young man in Canada answer, which is playing in the NHL, which wasn't in the cards. Right. You know, I would love to be, you know, guiding, skiing or mountain biking and outside in the mountains on any given day. I do feel like my natural sort of zen comes in the outdoors, and I've spent most of my life enjoying those types of activities out there in places that take your breath away. They're so beautiful. We live in a beautiful country, and I feel like sometimes we don't always give it the credit that it deserves.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thanks, Ben. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed the conversation, and hopefully, you know, there's an idea out there for someone that can take, you know, some of this thinking, some of these conversations to the next level and help us, you know, change that trajectory to one that's happening much more quickly.
As hopefully all of our listeners know, the City Age podcast is just one piece of what City Age offers. We run digital and in-person events about the future of cities, as well as other topics, including data and the future of food.
When it comes to our food's future programming, our founding partner and one of our most valued collaborators is Emily, or the Enterprise Machine Intelligence and Learning Initiative. They're an industry-led nonprofit organization established to accelerate the growth of the digital agriculture ecosystem. Emily's latest flagship project is Innovation Farms, a 5,500-acre smart farm in Manitoba, where new technologies will be tested, validated, and put through their paces to show how they contribute to the sustainable, productive growth of Canadian agriculture.
Emily is sponsoring today's episode of the City Age podcast, and we are so grateful for their support. To learn more about how Emily is building the future of food and farming in Canada, visit emilycanada.com or follow Emily_Canada on Twitter.
Anna, thank you very much for the conversation with Ben. Ben will be joining us live for City Age Toronto, the next 10 million, which is an in-person event we're hosting on April 26th, where we'll explore how Canada can prepare for historic population growth. If you want to hear more from Ben and our other excellent speakers, head to cityage.com to get your tickets.
Speaking of population growth, next up is our chat with Christine Bergeron, President and CEO of Vancity. We sat down with Christine to talk primarily about how Vancity is financing affordable housing in a time of rapid urban growth, but also about Vancity's business model in general and how they prioritize people, profits, and the planet all at the same time.
Prior to becoming CEO, Christine held several senior leadership roles within Vancity, including serving as Vancity's Chief Member Services Officer. And prior to Vancity, she spent her career working in early stage venture capital, public markets, and broadly with entrepreneurs, financing innovative companies and building financial firms, all focused within the clean tech, sustainability, and impact investing sectors. Enjoy.
Vancity is a leader in values-based finance. I'm wondering if you can start out by telling us what that means.
Yeah, sure. So when you join Vancity, you become a member. So our shareholders are our members, so they are our owners. And that's a pretty fundamental difference than other financial institutions. And that's because we are, as a credit union, we are a cooperative. And so it's your membership is your ownership. And so, you know, in terms of values-based finance, we've been leading the way, you know, really since we were founded 75 years ago, more than 75 years ago now. So there were a group of 14 working class individuals that came together to start what is now Vancity. And the principles of inclusion and social justice, you know, were really embedded right, you know, at that time. And so we give back 30% of our profits to our members and communities every year. And then the impact really of our actions on people and planet is what's ingrained. So it's ingrained in how we make our profits, as well as what we do with them. So we have a triple bottom line business model that's measurable. So triple bottom line being people, planet, profit. And we measure that. So, you know, how much of our assets as an institution are we using to lend to people, you know, who are developing green buildings, or that where we can serve those who are underserved. So things like that. And we really consider the impact on people and planet in all of our business decisions. So the lending one is obvious, but it's things like procurement, our own people, our wealth management assets, and things like that.
You started out as a venture capitalist and have worked in Silicon Valley. So I'm wondering if you can tell us about what you learned from the earlier years in your career and why you got involved in impact investing.
I started my business career as a venture capitalist. So that was already more than 20 years ago. So I was actually based here in Vancouver, and I went back and forth between Vancouver and Silicon Valley quite a bit. So it was really exciting time. You know, I was focused on clean tech, and so things like hydrogen and fuel cells. So lots of innovation and entrepreneurship was happening. And there was, of course, as there continues to be, a lot of money being invested. And what I realized, though, through all of those years was that I really felt something was missing. So in all of that really incredible, you know, churn, like there's talent, there's for sure energy and money, so many of the important global problems were basically ignored by capital. And it was really chasing things like social platforms. And so there was a bit of money going to clean technology, but in comparison, you know, the vast majority was not. And so we got a lot of connected technologies, which have, of course, you know, radically changed our world. They've created growth and, you know, at times like concentration of wealth, so not necessarily wealth for all. But we also still have conflict. We've got runaway inequality and arguably a planet in crisis. And so, you know, after the venture work, I spent a few years in public markets actually with a hedge fund before I then leaned into impact investing. And so like clean tech, you know, 20 years ago, it really wasn't a term or an area that people were familiar with. So there were a few reasons that I did that. I moved into impact investing, and it actually really started about a conversation around clean tech 2.0, you know, which was really talking about the business beyond only that which is being produced, right? So not just about, you know, what solar technology is being produced, but also how do you operate your business? You know, how do you think about your stakeholders? How can you both create and run a better business by thinking about all those stakeholders? So the environment, your community, your employees, and really going beyond that single shareholder and single goods or service that you're actually producing to that broader lens. And so it wasn't very common back then, but it was pretty important to me. And I thought it was really that next lens on, you know, how to grow a business and how to do that in a way that would also benefit the community, you know, that you're in. So to me, you know, it's really great to see that conversation around impact on people and planets becoming more of the norm now, although it's not fully the norm. So that was sort of the way I moved into impact investing.
One of the key investment areas for Vancity is affordable housing, and that's what I'd really like to focus on. So to start off, can you just sort of tell us a little bit about how Vancity is addressing housing needs in particular? And also if you can say a little bit about how you as an organization kind of characterize the situation right now in Vancouver and in Canada more broadly and how you're approaching it.
Well, certainly Vancouver and all of our surrounding municipalities, you know, as those who live here know, are among the least affordable places to live, both in Canada and in the world. And our view is certainly that it's a very complex problem at this point. And so we do need all groups and, you know, every lever they have to looking for solutions. So as a financial institution, you know, we of course provide mortgages to members. We aren't a developer, so it's not as though we can increase the supply per se, or even make housing less expensive. You know, we don't have that magic wand, unfortunately. But there are areas where we've been able to think of creative solutions. So for example, you know, one of the problems in Metro Vancouver is that organizations, typically not-for-profit developers, who want to build affordable housing, who have the land, but they don't have the financing to reach the construction phase, because there's a lot that happens, you know, between those two phases. And it's actually quite a big barrier for affordable housing development. So it is one where a creative mindset combined with a values-based approach can help. You know, so that's sort of one example. And so it's why we have an affordable housing program. The purpose is actually to advance greater housing security, like more housing, right? And so it also is there to help with community well-being. So plan and develop the projects and again, help move that along. We also work with many affordable housing providers. You know, we look to support nonprofit groups that are part of the overall solution. So if we can't do it directly, we try to support that work indirectly through the profits that we give back. You know, it's in order to do the best that we can to help solve some of these system problems, even though we can't actually do all of it, right? And so over the years, we've also worked with members as they look to perhaps take a property and redevelop it, you know, work with them on how to increase the number of affordable housing units within a new development. So there's lots of different aspects to it. And it's certainly something that we know and we hear from our membership all the time that is, you know, it's difficult for them, the affordability broadly, you know, in our region. And so much of that stems from the housing element.
I know this is sort of a multifaceted approach and strategy that you have to increasing affordable housing. So I want to walk through a couple of the examples a bit more concretely. Can we start with the Affordable Housing Accelerator Fund? Can you tell me a bit about how that works?
So the fund provides low-cost loans to advance project development of purpose-built, affordable, and, you know, more and more, we're trying to make sure climate-ready rental homes. And, you know, the events from the last couple of years make that really clear that they need to be purposeful and affordable, but also, you know, ready to deal with the climate-related issues we're seeing. And that these homes are owned by community housing sector broadly. And, you know, it often links into what I was saying before, that they've got land, but they can't fully get to that next stage. So the repayment of the loans, so principal interest, is delayed until developers have received construction financing, or they're accruing rental income or a different means of like agreed upon finance. So it basically allows for a delay in those repayments, and the funding bridges the gaps basically to build affordable homes and support housing development.
Right.
I think the fund so far has supported more than 4,000 units of affordable housing actually. Yeah. So it's really been a great success.
Yeah. What are some of the other ways that VanCity is driving affordable housing? So I know there's some work happening with housing above your branches. There's work with Canada's Mortgage and Housing Corporation. What are just some of the other examples off the top of your head?
Yeah. So we don't claim to be driving affordable housing, you know, systemically, because that's a really tough one, but we're certainly trying to play our part in the overall solution.
Right.
So we have a few other levers. Yeah. Some of what you had indicated, if we've got a wholly owned subsidiary called VanCity Investment, a community investment bank, and it's partnered up with CMHC, Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation, basically to create a broader, you know, affordable housing program. So that's one where, you know, we've provided just under $200 million in financing for about 1,000 affordable housing units. And that's really about trying to keep within the development of the cooperative economy. So supporting the co-op housing movement by offering financing that really meets the specific needs of each housing co-op. We think there's a lot more that can be done within that co-op sector. The other area, you know, within the cooperative areas, even on building repairs for co-ops, because of how they're structured, it can be more difficult to get the right financing. So we've been doing that for quite a few years now. And so the bank has also done that in terms of becoming a financial partner and teaming up with CMHC in that regard. And so we've done, you know, some other areas where we look at affordable housing rentals. Again, you know, you can look in a neighborhood, and if you're losing some of that housing to gentrification or rent evictions, right, which we've seen in many neighborhoods across the country, we've created a preserve and protect guarantee program. So it's really trying to allow organizations to obtain financial approval in advance so that when there is an opportunity to buy something that's at risk, they can move really quickly. So those are some of the examples, because if not, right, if you're too slow to get to that purchase, then it's gone and you can't, you know, you're not able to keep it in the neighborhood.
Can you tell me whether or not there's any sort of guiding lesson or a major takeaway that you've kind of taken on through your work in particular when it comes to housing with VanCity? Like, is there some sort of guiding principle you've extracted from the lessons you've learned?
Oh, a guiding principle. I mean, I think for us, our guiding principles tend to be similar, whether it's affordable housing, whether it's climate, whether it's reconciliation, which is really around trying to center the decisions around people and trying to think about creative solutions for the best outcome. And that maybe sounds quite high level, but it is actually, it does actually help us think through how else can we do it? Why not, right? Mm-hmm. If you really get down to the granular level, you think about the people who are being displaced, or, you know, you think, oh, well, they're doing some renovations on a building. That's great. Until you really understand the nuance of what that means for those people who can no longer afford to live there. And I think that tends to really guide us in, again, in that creativity and in just keep coming at, you know, well, how else could we look to support what people are trying to do?
There's lots of public dialogue about Canada's housing crisis. I think in particular in Toronto and Vancouver, this is very acute. Mm-hmm. Is there something you think people get wrong about it in those public conversations or in the public dialogue?
I'm not so sure that people get it wrong. I do think that the issue is more complex than most of the discussions that take place. Like, it's quite nuanced for sure. So I'm not sure people get it wrong. I do think that there are many creative solutions that can be brought to the problem. And that, again, you know, there are many people across the country working on these, whether it's thinking about, you know, how can a group of people share a home, right? How can we, you know, we've been providing those types of offerings to groups, and they're tricky, but they're doable. Or how else can we think about co-op housing? Like, what, you know, again, coming back to it just with a solution oriented mindset, because we need all of them. Like, we need all those solutions because it's so complex. But I'm not sure that people necessarily get it wrong. I mean, they certainly get it from the perspective that they have, that they're in it. And so different people will see that differently, for sure.
Kind of on the flip side of that question, going forward more broadly than housing, talk to me a little bit about what role you think financial institutions need to be playing in tackling those major challenges of our time.
I think it starts by recognizing that financial institutions control, you know, trillions of dollars around the world and have an enormous impact on the direction of an economy, right? And if the economy isn't centered around people, each of us, you know, all of us together, it isn't really about anything that's going to matter much at all in the long term. And so we do have a big role as a financial institution in pushing capital to support our communities for a sustainable future. I would say it this way: who, you know, financial institutions lend to and what they support financially absolutely shapes the economy that we'll have in the future. And it's both. It's the who and the what. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes we can get focused on the what, you know, again, like we were saying before, clean technology, but it's also who, you know, those who've typically been underserved by the banking system. And by that, that's not simply whether you have a bank account, but how do you get credit? What does that look like? How can they grow their business? Who gets funded and who doesn't really matters. And it especially matters in aggregate. So as an example, you know, you can build a lot of equity by starting and growing a business. And often, you know, being able to get a loan to grow it can make a lot of sense financially. Mm-hmm. But you have to be able to get that. And that hasn't typically been the same for everyone. Mm-hmm. So I think that financial institutions do play a role. And frankly, whether they even think that they do or not, because they're making those decisions every day on who and what. And again, in aggregate, that shapes, you know, future outcomes.
Right.
And so I think they do play a role. I think it's an important role. I wouldn't want it to sound like it's all on financial institutions, you know, to try to solve, because again, they're really complex problems. And I would say it's about what lever you have as a business to affect change. So for a financial institution, one of those key levers is that who and what you lend to or invest in. for other businesses, there are other really large levers, like where you source from, et cetera. And so every business, you know, should really think about what lever they have. Because again, oftentimes you're actually, if you're not thinking about it, you're also making decisions about the future. And so being thoughtful and deliberate is really important, especially right now.
We always ask a few rapid fire questions at the end of our interviews just to help us get to know you a little bit better. So I'll start with those. What's one thing you wish you could tell your younger self working in Silicon Valley?
I think I would probably remind myself, because I did at times think this, but I didn't have the benefit of the next 20 years of experience to kind of look back. So I would remind myself how valuable it is to learn everything I could or I can at the time about finance, about how the system of finance works, because it will, you know, again, if I'm speaking to my younger self, it'll serve me really well later in my career, because knowing something really well is the best way to be able to do it differently.
What's the best advice that anyone has ever given you?
Oh gosh, I've gotten a lot of good advice over the years that's been helpful in the moment. I think one important one was go where the leadership is needed and not to what you know the best.
What is a city that has surprised you recently?
Oh, so last summer we traveled to Amsterdam, where I have family, and it didn't surprise me because I'd been, but it did surprise my boys, who found it really awesome that there are more bikes than cars there. So we explored the entire city, you know, in the area by bike, and it surprised them and they thought it was really, really fun. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on the show, Christine. We really appreciate you taking the time and chatting with us.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Thank you, Anna, for the interview with Ben. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Christine. I had the pleasure of meeting Christine at our event in Vancouver late last year. Her presentation was definitely a highlight of the day, actually. I'm thrilled we were able to have her on the podcast as well.
That's it for today. This was the City Age podcast, and we'll see you next time. After all, you can't build the future alone.